Welcome everyone, I'm Sabina Dietrich, the Director of the Urban and Regional Analysis Program here at UXER. And this is our last and final brown bag of the school year. School's been out for us for a few weeks, but Ana Santiago from Michigan State is here for exacting a pound of flesh, neighborhood and environments, childhood food insecurity, and obesity. And we're very happy to welcome Ana here to Pitt. She is professor of social work at Michigan State University and received her interdisciplinary PhD in urban social institutions from the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. Ana is a Milwaukee native too. From there, she did postgraduate research training in the University of Michigan and has taught at Wayne State, Case Western, and at Michigan State. Her work has been really, really exciting on a number of things, and she's received funding from United States Department of Housing and Urban Development, the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development, Ford Foundation, MacArthur, Annie E. Casey, Social Science Research Council, and the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. I've been following Ana and George Galster's work for quite some time because they have been working with a really extraordinary set of information and data from the Denver Housing Authority. She's going to talk about what a 20-year collaboration? 22-year collaboration that she and they have had and how that got started. They, you know, kind of clean up on the Best Article Awards of 2015, our Urban Affairs Association conference, where a lot of us know each other from. That she and George Galster, along with Lisa Stark's article, won the Best Conference Article. So out of that amazing set of information that they've been generating, incredibly important research, we're going to exact a pound of flesh today. So welcome.
Thank you, and thank you for coming. And this is not how I normally sound, but this is how I sound with allergies.
Yeah,
so,
right.
And we actually do talk about asthma in our study too, which is quite high actually in our student our child population. Sabina asked me to say a couple of things, a little bit about the context of, because George and I and our team never lived in Denver. But we've been doing successful work with the Denver Housing Authority for now, this is our 22nd year. And part of it was that we were originally part of the Yonkers segregation project in, as an advisory team and the research advisory team for them in the late 80s, early 90s. And what brought us to Denver is that Denver actually created their public housing and scattered it from its inception since 1938. And they went to a scattered site dispersed housing program, which is what they call it. In 1969, they started that program long before it was on the radar screen for HUD. And so we knew about the program. They ran into some trouble in the mid to late 1980s because HUD required all housing authorities to publicly announce the siting of any new units. And they had been doing it with the city council since 1969, but the people didn't necessarily put things together. And so they wound up having quite an outcry in Denver about what they felt was concentration of these dispersed units. And George testified on behalf of the authority in 1988 when they were going through this process. But what this process developed, which was why we wound up going there, is they created a common wait list. They also had some things about making sure there wasn't over densification of subsidized units, especially their dispersed units. And so they did some things that wound up creating what became a natural experiment which we could use. And so I spent 2.5 years in the field building relationships, started our work in 1994, talking with them at length. and building relations and doing some small projects then led to a series of studies. So we've done basically six studies using, working with our community partners, which are mainly the Denver, the Housing Authority of the City and County of Denver, as well as the Piton Foundation, which is one of the NNIP programs that provide data for folks in Denver. So we had access to some both administrative data as well as neighborhood data, and not necessarily widely accessible neighborhood data that we've been using for our studies, and then we've done quite a bit of field work. So I've been out in that field since 94. There were times when we were running several studies concurrently, and so we had a staff of about 36 folks, and we actually did most of our work either going out in teams on a regular basis or doing things remotely, you know, mainly by phone with our folks. But I know a lot of our, over the course of the various studies, we've interacted with about 2,500 families. And I actually know quite a few of them personally because I've done a lot of those interviews. So it just gives you an idea. But one of the things that was interesting about this common wait list that they developed, and it started officially on January 1st of 1987, is that anybody that met the requirements to be on the wait list, which is standard across housing authorities, you know, because there's income requirements, certainly, and et cetera, that as you came to the top of the wait list, your household or family was randomly assigned to a unit that met the bedroom size needs of your family. And so for people who are doing neighborhood effect studies, that's an important facet because most of us choose where we want to live. And we choose it for reasons like proximity to school, work, et cetera. And so when we're thinking about neighborhood effects, one of the things that confounds that with most of the research that's done, including some of the things that might be done here, and when you start aggregating census tract data and with other things, is that you have no sense of what motivated the people to live in those neighborhoods to begin with. And whether those motivations have anything to do with the outcomes that you're interested in looking at, especially for kids. That's the thing. So because if you move to a neighborhood because you value access to parks or rec centers, that may have an impact on whether or not those kids are eating well, or maybe if they're active and things like that. And so it could be something related to these what we call parental characteristics that's driving the outcome instead of the neighborhood. And so one of the reasons why we chose to work in with Denver on this, on our work, is that it provided a natural experiment to test, because we're removing that sense of choice of neighborhood. And so these folks are really, and for the most part, it's not quite perfect as an experimental design, but for the most part, folks went to their first assigned neighborhood units, and then we could see then what was the effect of living in those residential areas, trying to extricate these parental characteristics that might also shape those particular outcomes for kids. So that gives you a little bit of a nutshell. And so we're trying to get a lot of things published right now, but we have certainly been talking about what's the next project with them. So As it's been mentioned, we've had a number of we've had about $3 million of funding for our Denver work, and so these are certainly our funders, and we certainly acknowledge their belief in the work that we've done and support for our work. So the work I'm presenting is from what we call our last study, which is the Denver Child Study. And that actually was fielded starting in 2005. We did our pilot work, and then we did our main interviews between 2006 and 2008. And so what that child study was about was to take advantage of this natural experiment and look at what particular neighborhood contexts affect a whole range of child outcomes through childhood. So we're looking at, you know, both physical and mental health, looking at behaviors, looking at school outcomes, looking at marriage and fertility for the older kids, looking at employment and post, basically young adult kind of outcomes, mainly in education and employment, and we also looked at exposure to violence. So those are the main domains. So we have a whole series of papers. Now we have about 12 that are out. And the large panel study for this is one that's published by HUD called Opportunity Neighborhoods for Latino and African American Children. And so that gives kind of like the general results, and then we've been doing some more detailed findings since then. So this is obviously one of the domains that we're looking at in terms of the physical health. So what I'd like to... We were interested in obesity, certainly. There's clearly a literature out there that says that neighborhoods may have some effect on kids' activity, physical activity, as well as access to healthy foods. And so we'll certainly be developing that out in a few minutes. But for just to, so we're all on the same page, when we're looking at food insecurity, we're looking at limited or uncertain availability or access. You just don't have physical access to healthy foods, or you have limited or uncertain ability to pay for access to acquire these healthy foods. And when we're looking at, and I'm going to use the term obesity, but really what I'm talking about here is we're looking at kids that were this is a self-report from our caregivers that said that their children had been diagnosed as overweight or obese. And just so that you know, when we're looking at, that's basically at the 85th percentile or higher in a child's weight. And that's also obviously based on weight, on age. So approximately one out of five kids in the U.S. experience food insecurity at any point in a given year. And then we also know that about one-third of children are considered to be overweight or obese. The prevalence of food insecurity and obesity are both disproportionately higher for low-income and minority kids. Food insecurity and obesity have been linked to poorer health and developmental outcomes across childhood. Children who are food insecure or obese are more likely to be in fair or poor health, have increased hospitalizations, have heightened risk for type 2 diabetes, heightened risk for hypertension, cardiovascular disease, asthma, and sleep apnea, not only during childhood, but also moving into adulthood. They also tend to have lower academic performance, loss of school days, repeated grades, and assignment to special education, as well as more behavioral or attention problems, self-control issues, and tend to receive mental health counseling for low self-esteem, anxiety, and depression. What's really interesting is that although it seems counterintuitive, food insecurity is also linked to greater risks of childhood obesity, risks that are already elevated amongst these low-income and minority children. Children who are food insecure often experience lower diet quality and less variety of food. So there's the tendency to have access to highly processed and calorie-dense foods that tend to contribute to weight gain. And then what adds to this is that the unpredictable availability of food tends to lead to cycles of overeating. And there's been a couple of recent studies that have come out in the last month or so that have been talking about these things, including that if you're looking at obesity in later life, how these patterns really kind of reset your body in terms of issues of metabolism, and you run into these problems later on. And that this whole binging and cycling of eating that you wind up happening because of being food insecure are basically kind of your default patterns of eating when you start experiencing like anxiety or whatever as you're an adult. So it's a kind of interesting discussion there. So a lot of the existing research literature has re-examined the role of individual behavioral and family level factors on childhood food insecurity and obesity. It's really been more recent that you've seen more work that's started to focus on what kind of neighborhood environments influence both the prevalence as well as onset of food insecurity and obesity in childhood, especially the roles of neighborhood disadvantage, socialization, social cohesion and control, exposure to violence, institutional resources, physical surroundings, and exposure to environmental contamination on issues related to access to both healthy foods and physical activity. So many of the links have really focused on how do some of these neighborhood contexts affect whether or not you can actually access foods. Do you have access to full-service grocery stores, for example? Or to what extent do they impact the level of walkability, use being outside to play, et cetera. But there's, even though there's some thoughts about this, most of the literature tends to focus on one or two of these neighborhood contexts at a time. And oftentimes it's focusing on things like poverty rates. And I can tell you right now, poverty rates in and of themselves do not necessarily tell you much about neighborhood effects. Because we're finding a lot of things other than poverty that are predicting. Even though there's been this increased work that's been done, there's still a lot of questions that remain about what are the magnitudes of the effects, and more importantly, what are the mechanisms? So even if you have something like poverty, so what is it about poverty that is underlying what's happening with the kids? What I'm doing in this paper is trying to address two basic questions. So for the first one is, for Latino and African American children who spent a significant fraction of their childhood living in subsidized public housing, and what we mean by this, they had to have lived at least 2 years in public housing to be considered part of this sample. Are there significant differences in the prevalence and age of onset of both food insecurity and obesity? And what are those neighborhood contexts that affect that? And then the second question is, what is that relationship between food insecurity and childhood obesity? So one of the things I can say is that some of the contributions that our Denver Child Study is making to this larger literature is that we're using a natural experiment that involves these public housing tenants and their children to avoid this, what we call either parental selection bias or location selection bias. The terms really are referring to the same thing, something I had addressed earlier, the extent to which other kinds of motivations might be really driving the outcomes. And then we examine the differences in prevalence and age of onset of food insecurity and the diagnosis of obesity for low-income Latino and African-American children. A lot of the neighborhood effects literature still really tends to mainly focus on African-American children, very little about Latinos. And then we have an unprecedented set of neighborhood context measures that we can look at. So we've created a file, and I'll talk about this in a little bit more in detail, that for every year of a child's life, we know what their characteristics were, what their family and household characteristics were, the characteristics of the caregiver, and what the neighborhood characteristics were. So we can look at that and see what was happening over the course of childhood. So what I'm doing today is an analysis that's going to be based on a sample of about 750 of our children. Our total sample of kids is about 1,700 kids, but what constrains our sample is two things. We're looking at kids that were between the ages of 2 and 18, because they have to have at least lived 2 years in public housing, and the food insecurity episode had to occur after they were initially assigned to their Denver housing neighborhood, and obesity, a diagnosis, had to occur afterwards. So we had, so what happens is we have a number of kids that experienced food insecurity before that. And so, so that's what restricts some of the sampling there. So just to let you know. What we do to, in the analyses, and I'll talk about this in, again in a little bit more detail in a minute, is we're looking at what's, how is the delay or onset of food insecurity conditioned about for neighborhoods. So we're using what's called accelerated failure time models to look at that. And then we're also looking at the risks. What are the risks of obesity? And using what we call Cox proportional hazard models. So those are the main empirical models that I'm using. What we've also, what I've also done in this is test the robustness of the results with different kinds of models. So we're looking at what if we look at what we call contemporaneous or current neighborhood conditions. How does that affect the onset of food insecurity and then later a diagnosis of obesity? We look at what if we say, well, these kids, they might have moved from their initial neighborhoods. What if we look at the neighborhood conditions where they were first located, and what are those effects? So what are the neighborhood conditions? And then we do a couple of things that are related more, like the intent to treat models and the treatment on the treated models, for those of you who are more interested in those kind of modeling techniques. We're trying to look at, we use instrumental variables. So we predicted current conditions based off of first offer conditions to also see what would have happened. So if anybody moved, what would have been like if they would have stayed in the same initially assigned unit for all of their time during childhood on the impact. So we run several of those models. The results are very consistent, but at least you'll know when you see them that we did. So we're using a theoretical model that really look at Bronfenbrenner's ecological theory of human development. So we're saying basically in the food security models that we have individual, and then we have caregiver and household, and then we have neighborhood conditions that all would influence, in this case, the onset or the delay of onset of food insecurity. And then what we do in the cumulative risk models for obesity is that obesity, even though it's very prevalent, was relatively underdiagnosed in our student, in our child population. And so we go into using cumulative risk factors, in it, which I'll talk about in further detail. But we're looking at a child risk factor. These are all based on the literature. You're more likely to be obese if you're male, if you're firstborn, and if you have a high birth weight. You're more likely, and there's household risk factors, there's a caregiver risk factor. And what's important here is we're looking at the mediating effect of a prior episode of food insecurity on whether that triggers a diagnosis of obesity later. And then we have several indicators of neighborhood risks. Safety risks, and then also socioeconomic status risks. And then we have one protective factor, which is looking at what we call an access to not only healthy food, but also resources like parks and rec centers, as well as walkability. So those are the kind of modeling that we're using to look at this particular phenomena. I can tell you right now that one thing is that there's significant neighborhood effects that increase the risk of food insecurity, and conditioned on that prior episode of food insecurity, a diagnosis of obesity in childhood. There are also some significant ethnic differences. In our models, this is a much stronger model for whatever reason. We can have some conversation, hopefully, about it for Latino kids than it is for African American kids. So that gives you a little bit of foreshadowing of what we're going to see. So I started to talk a little bit about this larger study. As I said, we're using a natural experiment. we've done a lot of balancing tests, various tests to see whether or not there was a true random experiment. And anyone that's interested, I'll be happy to talk about them further later. But we basically included all households that had that were Latino or African American that had entered the Denver Housing Authority as January 1st or later up to December of 2005. They had children that were age appropriate. They had to be under 18 when they first moved in. They had to have lived in DHA housing for at least 2 years. And they had to have had, again, an episode of food insecurity and obesity that occurred after they had been randomly assigned to their Denver Housing Authority unit. So that's what brings it down to just under 260 kids that are in what we call the intent to treat treated models, and then the treatment on the treated models, which are restricted to only those kids whose families actually accepted their first offer. That's what brings it down to 541. So these were done by phone, but also in person. About 20% of our interviews occurred in person between April of 2006 and February of 2008. Believe it or not, it took us nearly 4 years to put the data set together. Just in terms of being able to verify every little piece of information and add everything. So we geocoded their residential address histories, and then put together all of the census tract as well as Piton Foundation neighborhood indicators. We also have quite an array of indicators about neighborhood context from the actual survey data. But like I said, if we wound up then creating what would be, it's kind of like a retrospective panel of children's information. Again, for every year of life, we can know what was happening with that child, the caregiver, the household, and the neighborhood. So it was quite an undertaking to put these together and then make sure that everything was checked and rechecked that they matched. So what can I say about what we found? In the survey, that's where we draw our true dependent variables, right? Food insecurity was measured by a question asking about the times and where they lived when they did not have enough money to buy food. That I know is one of the indicators for food insecurity, and I know that there's other ones that are used in the government definitions, but this is the one that we have, and it seems to be pretty consistent in terms of being able. So we asked, okay, when you lived at place X, did you have problems buying food, on a regular basis, and so we know this for every place where the child lived. On the obesity side, and this is obviously we don't have the BMI kind of measures because, and I'll tell you why in a minute. But we asked them for, we asked the caregivers when they feel free to come into the kitchen. No, sorry.
Somebody else.
All right. So we asked the caregivers whether their child had been diagnosed as being overweight or obese. So when they actually got a diagnosis, not if they considered them or whatever. That's how we asked that question. The reason why we don't do the BMI kinds of measures, you have to understand, is we have kids that were. Our final sample of kids at the time of survey ranged anywhere from being several years old to being 35 years old. So having curved measures of BMI on these older kids wouldn't have made any sense because you're asking about things during childhood. So that's certainly one of the, because it's not a cohort that we're finding of 10-year-olds that we follow through time. That's not how that worked. But, so what did we find? As you can see from what's on here is that, on this particular slide, is that over half of the kids experienced an episode of food insecurity after they had been initially assigned to DHA. So these are already economically vulnerable families to begin with, oftentimes that's why they are in housing, right? They're in public housing, but they were continuing to experience episodes of food insecurity afterwards. And it's not, so the average age of time when they first, their first episode was when they were 4. And our kids in the study experience food insecurity on average of 7.7 years during childhood. So that experiencing it early and for very sustained periods of time. Although the actual age of first experience and total number of years of food insecurity really didn't vary by ethnicity and gender, what we did find is that Latino children were significantly less likely to experience food insecurity relative to the African American kids. And that difference was particularly strong between Latino and African American females. Now, if we were, now what we have here, the comparable data in Denver would suggest about 25% of all kids in Denver are food insecure, but that's looking at all children, not just low income kids, which our kids are. And so, one of the things that's important to note is that about 31% of the kids that are food insecure in Denver are not eligible for subsidized nutrition programs, either because of income ineligibility or immigration status. Now, one of the things that, and again, we acknowledge that, again, the caregivers were asked about a medical diagnosis of obesity, overweight or obesity, and so the full sample is about 5.2% of all the kids. That's very low. The Denver averages are about 30%.
I was going to say, those are low, aren't they?
They're very low, and I can tell you now, one of the things that we've talked to medical folks about this, couple of things that could be happening with that reporting of caregiver reporting of obesity. One is cultural differences in terms of what is considered healthy weight versus being obese. That's clearly one aspect of it. But the other thing with medical personnel that we've talked to about this, they've also said that if you're looking at a family that has a lot of issues going on, that may be the least of the concerns, so they don't even worry about it. I'm not saying that that's right, but that certainly is one of the things that have been talked about. Even though these percentages are low, there's clearly Latino girls and boys were more likely to have that diagnosis than African American kids in the study.
Can you go back to the age of onset of food insecurity for a second? That was determined by parent report or recollection?
It's obviously the reporting, and because of the retrospective discussion, it's certainly... Now, the age was, they didn't tell me what age. We asked them where were they living, and then we determined the age because we know when they were living at certain points. That's how we did it. We didn't ask them, how old was your kid? Yeah, so yes, I understand very much.
Yeah.
So again, very underreported. However, there are, as I said, we think there are some things that might be going on in terms of why they weren't diagnosed. It could also be access to health care as well, and in terms of whether that even happens. So this is a number of things like that. Mm-hmm.
And then the consistency across the age and time of diagnosis.
Yeah, so they're basically late elementary going into middle school, right? So, and they're in a case, Denver is in a K through five, and then middle school is 6 through 8, so it's kind of like at that transition time when you think that they'd be in middle, moving over into middle school maybe.
And I'm wondering too, if the school nurse component might have something to do with it. I'm not sure when the school nurses start, but they do send that form home now to the parents informing them that your child might be obese or overweight, and there's that little chart that they send.
And again, there may be a timing thing that, because remember, our kids could have been basically, we're talking about almost a 40-year span when these were children. So they could have been in the 70s up and through, right? And so that's, so how those practices were done earlier, that could also be an effect of that. Now, nowadays, you know, again, we haven't looked at whether this is really with the youngest of the kids, but possibly we could see whether or not there was that diagnosis based on that. Mm-hmm. And then think of that maybe as a period effect, as a timing, a history effect. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on these models unless you have questions about them. But basically what the accelerated failure time models with frailties is doing is we're trying to look at whether onset of food insecurity is either accelerated or delayed during childhood. The frailties part of this is that we can do analyses that account for the fact that we have kids that are clustered in families. What we cannot do is we cannot cluster by neighborhood, if those of you are asking, because our kids are not living in this, they might be living in the same neighborhood, but there could be 40 years of difference of when they were living. Okay, so we're not, again, we're not following a cohort of like infants through childhood. We're really doing it retrospectively with this group of kids. And so we can pull them back into those neighborhoods based on where they were living, but we can't cluster by that. But we can cluster by families, and we do. I'm going to report basically using standard deviations, which are normalized results. And then what we also have done is looked at, you know, I've done is looking at gender and ethnicity. And I slip back into the we because obviously I have folks that have worked with this as well in addition to what I'm presenting today. So what are some of the neighborhood characteristics? And I can spend a lot more time on these if you have specific questions. Our social vulnerability score is the closest to what you might know of as either concentrated disadvantage or neighborhood disadvantage. That's and it's based on some of the same kind of components, but I'll tell you why we use ours instead of using the traditional indicators. We conducted, again, there's a 40-year time span, census time span, and what we found is that what drives some of the neighborhood changes that were occurring in Denver was not consistent over across the 40 years. And that's a real important thing to know. So our social vulnerability index really focuses on poverty rate, unemployment rate, female headship, and the percentage of renters, because those were fairly stable indicators across the 40-year span. Okay. We use occupational prestige kind of to look, so we're looking at the vulnerability kind of looks at the more disadvantaged, and the occupational prestige looks at more of the idea of affluence. Because in neighborhood effect studies, what's important, it's not just who's poor in the neighborhood, but also who might be affluent in the neighborhood that could be driving results. And so we use the occupational prestige score that's kind of the, has been derived using the general social survey, and it's basically the weighted score of the different distribution of occupations of employees across a given census tract. All right, and then we have the PTON neighborhood data. What PTON reports is often the data that you wouldn't, they're not census data. So things, in this particular analysis, it's the property and violent crime rates per thousand that we have. And a PTON neighborhood is about the equivalent of two census tracts, but they're very well-defined neighborhoods. So if I asked one of our respondents, where did you live, and they could say Lincoln or Auraria, I know exactly what neighborhood that is. And they would know, too, in the boundaries. So they're very well-known and well-defined neighborhood units in Denver. And then we asked some additional questions about social capital and institutional resources. Just very briefly, our social capital index includes, these are respondent reports of whether or not they had people that could get together to solve neighborhood problems, would watch out for their children and property, knew them and their children by name, whether they and their children, they had people that they could look up to in the neighborhood, and if they had neighbors who they could count on for times of trouble, as well as an indicator looking at their participation in any neighborhood organizations like block clubs, tenant groups, etc. Our institutional resources indicator is I'm not going to go into all the details. We use item response theory to generate a latent factor for these. But basically what we're looking at is the presence during these different child years of life of parks, recreation centers, mentoring or counseling centers, subsidized daycare facilities, and good police protection. And the higher values on this particular score would mean that these are neighborhoods that have clusterings of these particular resources. So we also control for the ethnicity and gender of the child, as well as caregiver characteristics, as well as household characteristics. And if you have other questions about that, I'd be happy to share with you about that. So what do we find? So we're looking at either the accelerated or delay of onset of food insecurity. And so I just want to point out, these are contemporaneous models. So this is what would have happened at the time when this occurred. So they're contemporaneous. The first offer is neighborhood characteristics when they were first assigned to the neighborhood that they lived in. And then the last two columns are these instrumental variables that we created. The only difference between the two is that this group are all of the kids, so it's sort of like the average treatment effect, whereas the second one is only the kids where the families accepted their first offer and moved in to public housing. As you can see, that the results are particularly strong for the contemporaneous model. So point in time, right? The influence of those particular neighborhood characteristics, point in time. But we also find that there's some things that are consistent across several of the models. So what did we find here? And I'm probably going to talk about the contemporaneous model because it gives you more of a little some insights, and I'm going to give you some idea, some interpretation of what we think that these mean. So the risk factors for food insecurity seem to be residential instability, we have some safety issues with the violent crime rate. So it's the residential instability. You want to see these under one as a risk, and then if there's a acceleration of onset is under one, and a delay in onset is over one. So the risk factor is residential instability. So one standard deviation, percentage higher of residentially unstable neighbors. So there's a lot of people are moving in and out of that neighborhood, kind of churning in terms of population on a very high level. That shortened the time to an episode of food insecurity by about 20% or 25% in both the contemporaneous but also in the last, in the instrumental variable models. And then living in a neighborhood that had a very high fraction of pre-1940 housing also tended to accelerate food insecurity by about 20%, particularly it's only in that contemporaneous model. What we think that might be suggesting is a proxy for restricted access to either healthy foods, recreational facilities, walkability kinds of things. We think that's what it's picking up there. Now, for a delay in onset of food insecurity was associated with living in neighborhoods with higher occupational prestige, so more affluent neighborhoods. That's basically an 80% delay in onset, and about 1.4% in that ITT model. the percent foreign-born also had a 34 to 64% longer time to food insecurity, and that was consistent across several of those models.
Do you want to say a little bit more about that variable and performing that way? I mean, it's strong across all three.
Yeah, I'm going to say that.
Yeah.
So, with the occupational prestige, I have a question mark. We're wondering if that means the delay to onset is because they have more access, possibly, to foods. Well, you know, not sure. But if they're also living in more affluent neighborhoods, they may be also a little bit more affluent themselves.
Mm-hmm.
On the percent foreign-born, this is what we're thinking, and I'm open to any and all suggestions, is that we think that neighbors in these neighborhoods that have higher immigrant populations are not only willing to feed only their kids, but are feeding other neighborhood kids. You know, it's predominantly Latino and not necessarily Mexican, although it's heavily Mexican. There's also the immigrant blacks in Denver are Somalis. And so what may be happening here is, again, and these are, it's mainly kids being exposed to Latino neighbors that we're looking at here in this context. So the families will feed the kids. I mean, you know, if your kids are out playing with other kids, they'll call them in and they'll feed them. I mean, I think that's really what might be happening there. At least that's what we're conjecturing at this point in time. We also think that what might also happen in these immigrant neighborhoods is that there's a presence of ethnic grocery stores, and the ethnic grocery stores will also tend to sell more, would have some, a wider array of food choices than a convenience store. Right, so there. What's
and the kind of foods that people cook.
They're going to be cooking at home. Immigrant families are going to be cooking at home. You'd have some of the, and they also cook unhealthily too, but they also would have healthy food choices, and so it's a combination of those things. Now, what's interesting, and this is a very consistent pattern across a lot of our outcomes, violent crime rates tend to have what seems to be a protective effect on a lot of our outcomes, and it doesn't. And first of all, I want to point out that violent crime rates are relatively low in Denver, just so that even in the most violent neighborhoods in Denver, the average is only like 15 crimes per thousand for Denver as a whole, in the low 30s or 40s at the highest level. So they're relatively low compared to a lot of other places. What we think happens with this one in terms of it delays onset is that if you were truly living in a neighborhood that was less safe, you might be keeping those kids in and you're feeding them at home. You're cooking and feeding them at home. That's what we're thinking. We did some modeling, again, looking at stratified models, looking at African American and Latino kids. So this is what we're saying, and obviously the model is much stronger for the Latino kids. That's not always the case. It just happens to be in here, where you find some of the similar patterns that we saw in the full models. Although you have now property crime, if you're actually having a lot of street crime or property crime, then it accelerates the onset of food insecurity. So violent crime might not be enough to be generating people, you know, being so feeling unsafe and not whatever. But the property crime certainly will limit the access. I would imagine it limits the access to food sources. Because why would you necessarily cite a store if you're going to get robbed, or if you're going to have those kinds of things going on? What we find here, though, is the African American model. There's only two variables that are significant predictors of delaying onset, and they happen to be living in more affluent neighborhoods and living in more immigrant neighborhoods. Which is, again, this idea that perhaps what's happening, especially with the foreign-born, is that immigrant families are extending that kind of support to all kids in the neighborhood.
So what about obesity?
So we're using the Cox models. We're looking at the risk of an obesity diagnosis and whether it increases or decreases. What we did is I created a series of cumulative risk factors. Because the obesity rates that are reported are so low, that really limits the number of predictors you can have in your models. And so we created cumulative risk factors using what the literature said were individual factors that would contribute to the likelihood of being obese. And then and using some conventions in terms of, so if you were male, if you were firstborn, or and you were also high birth weight, that would be one risk factor. That's the child risk factor. And that each one of those, if you had one, would be counted as 1, 1, 1, so that would be a risk factor of 3. And so we did this at the child, caregiver, and household level using some of those same indicators. So that brought us down to effectively 6 risk factors plus ethnicity plus, because we can't do gender because gender's in the child risk factor. Ethnicity, and then we have this experience of food insecurity prior to obesity as the 8th variable, which stays in a model that is certainly more acceptable given the sparsity of our event of a diagnosis of obesity. So I've just talk about, I'll show these and here are some of those individual indicators that become part of that cumulative risk factor. So the higher, the more of these that you have, the higher is what your risk factor score would be. And so we have some on neighborhood safety, socioeconomic status, and then we have one protective factor that we're looking at, the percentage of living more than a mile from access to healthy food. And then the resource factor score, and then walkability. So what does that do in terms of results? What we find is, first of all, as we noted from our descriptives, once you control for all of these factors, African-American children are still much, much lower in terms of the risk of being diagnosed as obese during childhood in our study relative to the Latino kids. So it's basically about anywhere from 45 to 50, about 50% lower odds of being diagnosed as obese. I don't want to spend too much time on the child risk factor and the caregiver and the household risk factors, although we can see that they are predictive, but I wanted to focus on this prior episode of food insecurity. Very, very high rate of, so they're 2.2 times more likely, basically on average, of being diagnosed as obese if they had a prior episode of food insecurity. When we look at the neighborhood factors, I want to say point something out. I tested the mediating role of this. If the food insecurity indicator is not in the model, none of the neighborhood factors are significant. None of them are significant. It's only when you have that inclusion in the model, and it's only really in, actually, let me move back. You can't see it on the screen here. Unfortunately, it's on the bottom here. The neighborhood risk factor of it's an access. So what if you have this prior episode of food insecurity in the model, the only indicator, a neighborhood indicator that's significant is one of of the access to healthy foods, walkability, and the rest. So neighborhoods that have more access, those kids, there's a 75% higher odds of them being diagnosed as obese. So again, it's almost counterintuitive, isn't it?
And you see that particularly strong for Latino kids again, both in terms of the food insecurity episode as well as the access issue. I just wanted to show you this really quickly, and then I'll be able to wrap up in a minute here. This is Denver, and our kids are scattered pretty much throughout this whole area. So these are neighborhoods that actually have high access to healthy foods. The darker areas are the ones that have less access. So most of our kids, with a couple of exceptions of neighborhoods, are living in areas where they have access to healthy foods. And one thing to also note, again, this is Denver, almost all of our neighborhoods have access to parks. Or green space. So what do we come from some of this work? And again, this is kind of in progress. We know that, you know, almost half of the Latino kids and over half of the African American kids were food insecure after going into housing. It's an even higher percentage if we counted those that happened before. There's an accelerated onset of food insecurity that tends to be tied to issues of residential instability as well as physical surroundings. We think that has something to do with physical surroundings, mainly with the access issue of whether or not they physically have the access of healthy food. We think that might be driving some of that, but more importantly, the residential instability, you're not knowing your neighbors. If you are having problems with issues of food, you're not necessarily having other people helping and stepping in to help feed the kids, or that you can count on to help feed the kids. We already know that there's a very much smaller fraction of kids that are diagnosed as obese during childhood. I've already alluded to some of those reasons why that might be happening. One could be that they aren't seeing the doctors to be diagnosed. One could be that there's a real cultural difference in both African American and in Latino cultures about what's considered healthy and healthy weight. And so they're not concerned about their kids necessarily being obese, whether they are or not, in the same sense. Because I know in Latino culture, a chubby child is considered a healthy child. And if you're feeding a child and they look like they've been well fed, that means they're a healthy child. But we also think that, again, as medical providers suggest, that again, that may be one of a myriad of problems that our families might be facing, and that would be one thing that they might not say is as important as other things that they want to address. We also know that kids are more likely to be diagnosed as obese if they've had a prior food insecurity episode. But the increased availability of healthy foods, at least if we look at the contemporaneous model, is not necessarily equivalent to a lower risk of being diagnosed as obesity. And so the question is whether or not that's an access problem. And just because something is physically proximate doesn't mean it's accessible. Either you might not be able to afford it, or if you're looking at things like parks and rec centers or something, they might not be safe, or there might be still a quality issue. So I think that that's one thing to consider about that. Just because you're living close by, it doesn't necessarily translate in being something that is going to be protective and helping kids necessarily avoid becoming overweight or obese. We think that those effects are going to be mitigated by immigrant neighbors who are willing to support all kids in the neighborhood. And then there are several things that we were talking about, and Denver actually has been doing a lot of this, and the Housing Authority has been doing some of this. we certainly need to try to enhance both cost effectiveness of access, if so, or other ways of acquiring healthy food. So there's a lot of community gardens in many of the neighborhoods where these kids are living now. But also thinking about putting in local farmer markets or kind of those portable farm, those trucks to go out when necessary. They're doing much more education on healthy eating. One development in particular where a lot of our families lived has now created a healthy campus where they've done walking trails and did things to enhance safety in terms of using both walking areas as well as the rec center. But they've also instituted a culinary training program for the youth in the neighborhood. So they're teaching them those skills, but also teaching them how to engage in healthy eating. But those are some of the things that might be strategies to potentially look at. So that's it for now.
Thank you very much. Let's open up for questions and comments.
I had a question about the institutional resources. Mm-hmm. I think it was at the bottom of your models. Mm-hmm. Were those significant in any way? No,
and they haven't been. It's been interesting that they haven't been they've been only in a couple of our outcomes.
And those are participant self-reportive institutions.
So they're talking about whether or not they have good police protection, whether they live.
So it's quality.
And so it may be a quality issue.
Yeah.
More than an actual access issue again. Yeah.
One thing with immigrants and neighborhoods, I think immigrants typically have larger families, so there might be some things with people cooking already, like you said,
mm-hmm.
they're already planning a meal because they have a lot more, they have kids, and then other kids come in, and the availability of food in those neighborhoods. But that's something, did you ever think about doing some other kind of qualitative work around some of those to see? Indeed, those theories play out.
We've done some qualitative interviews with families and also the adult kids. We took the older kids to talk about something that didn't come up, but that wasn't a main focus of what we had done with them qualitative. But yeah, it would be interesting to go back and talk to them more about what's going on. I mean, I certainly know from being out there and working with the families that certainly is a plausible thing that's happening. But it would be good to get further corroboration from them.
Yeah, that seemed to be one of the factors that seemed interesting is how many people actually cook and prepare meals and have that in their house versus how many people that bring stuff in or people fend for themselves. And, you know, so I think that might become an important question.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some. If we were to come back, you know, people have asked us everything about trying to replicate this again, and it's like, oh my God, I don't know. But the reality would be is that, yeah, there's some things, because the larger survey was such a broad overview of various issues that if we would have just focused on health issues, we could have asked a lot more on some of those things about food preparation and things like that. But yeah, no, I think it would be interesting. And I'm sure that there could be some very strong differentials. For the different groups that we're looking at.
I think that issue of access and distance is important too. We had some students in the class were helping a group that was with parks, and they had some group done a series before and found out that the people in this neighborhood didn't use the park. The students then went and did some focus groups and found out that they didn't use that park, they used another park. And with just that one slice, people, they wouldn't have had the view of the people as park users. It's just that there is reasons why they didn't use one particular one.
Yeah.
And that.
I mean, and we actually do know about some of the access and some of the resources from our interviews and our more in-depth qualitative interviews with the kids especially. And we clearly there's an issue of financial access to some of the, you know, because some of the, as you saw, there are a lot of these neighborhoods and parks. Many of them have rec centers that are attached, and it's the cost, the fees that are associated with the rec centers that are keeping some of our families out of them, especially when you have multiple kids that you're trying to get in them. And so that's one of them. But the also thing is there's been some There definitely are concerns of, depending on where we're talking about in Denver, about the quality of those resources, and that there was a sense that they might not have been safe.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the parks especially might not be safe because there's enough drug and gang activity that occurs in the neighborhoods. And these are not public housing developments per se. When you're thinking about our public housing residents, I mean, we do have kids, we do have children that live in developments, but they're much more scattered than what you think they are. And then we have this whole layer of dispersed kids that are really, you know, wider range of neighborhood contexts, living in basically housing that's owned by the housing authority, but they're single family duplexes, threeplexes, fourplexes, and other residential neighborhoods.
Sure, if you mentioned this or not, but did you look at any of, I know this is HUD, but like city planning, like the concept of eminent domain where families are kind of forced out, or communities are like kind of forced to relocate, or did you only focus on just those who were public housing and got the lottery kind of system?
Well, they're not in a lot. I want to be real clear. These are not housing choice voucher families either. They're not. None of this is housing choice voucher. These are all public housing residents. They happen to have a scattered site program, but they're all are owned and operated by the housing authority. And so, the answer to your question is that some of our families had to have relocations that were involuntary based on changes to developments or units, right? But no, by and large, that wasn't issues like that of eminent domain and things like that were not an issue for these families because they really were residents of the public housing authority in their units.
So do you have, I mean, like in Pittsburgh, we have, you know, lots of racial segregation and a lot of the traditionally, you know, larger, more dense public housing developments were located within, you know, those neighborhoods, then exacerbating the poverty. So what does that look like in Denver?
It's very, very different. First of all, Latinos are the largest minority group in Denver. And their average segregation score is around 50. And the average segregation score for over time for African Americans is around 45. So they're much more scattered. Let me see if I can show you. But there is some concentration, but they're much more scattered. Let me show you a map here. So if you're looking at, actually, let me do the other one because it'll be easy to see. If you look at Denver, this corridor in here, which is going towards the airport, is one of the areas that would have some concentration of African Americans, but it's not. There's the percentages of African American in any given tract, as I remember correctly, is not even half. Right, it's less. Okay. And then you have Latinos are kind of all over the place, but there's some concentrations that are in this part in particular of Denver, and they've experienced continuing immigration. This is a long established Latino population that goes back 300 years, and then you have an immigrant population that's been more recent in the last 20, 30 years. Now those neighborhoods, again, as I recall, there's not any one neighborhood at this point that's even over 50% Latino. There's some that are certainly approaching majority, but so you don't have that same pattern of very highly segregated neighborhoods. And so you have a lot of spaces in Denver where you have both African American and Latinos living together, but also they're living with Anglos, with whites. And there's added to the mix is there's a significant Vietnamese population. So it's a really interesting kind of a dynamic where you don't see that. So you don't have this. They never had the very, you know, they don't have these very highly segregated public housing towers.
Right.
that's not their style of housing. The only towers that they have are for elderly. And then the rest of it is basically townhouse development, and they're fairly de-densified to begin with. So they're actually fairly, they're very well maintained. And so even in the public housing units across Denver, first of all, they're scattered. That was a historical decision that they made. They weren't going to put their developments just in one neighborhood in Denver. So they're scattered throughout. They're scattered through a good part of the city and county of Denver. And then their dispersed units are also even more deconcentrated. So it's a very interesting pattern that's very unlike what you see in this part of the country and certainly in the Midwest where I'm based. Very, very different.
So you don't have the same concentrations of poverty then either.
There's only one neighborhood that's basically, it's called Sun Valley. And I don't know if I can find it really quickly in here. There's only one neighborhood around in here that is about 70% poverty. That's the only neighborhood. And the only reason is that it's literally a neighborhood of it's one of the public housing developments predominantly, not, but it's surrounded by the freeways and other kinds of and some industrial development. So there's very little housing to begin with, and that's the main housing source, and that's the only one that's over. Other than that, poverty rates are in any of the other neighborhoods are well under 50%. So it's really a very different kind of a feel than what we see and experience here. I lived in the East too, but also in lived in Newark, outside of Newark. So, and then what you would see in the Midwest certainly that I'm familiar with.
So what's causing the housing instability? Theoretically, if you're living in, this kind of housing, then you should have reduced mobility, right?
Okay. So the public housing residents aren't the ones that are unstable. It's the surrounding neighborhood residents where there could be churning, right? And one of the things that happens is that over time, again, this is, you have to remember, this is a historical slice of 30 plus years. What you have is not only different economic cycles that cause some instability, including, they were one of the high foreclosure ones in the most recent recession, too. It was in Denver. Mm-hmm. But what you see, again, there's also a lot of speculation. So housing values went up tremendously during a lot of the period where a lot of these kids were talking about. And so you'd have people maybe being priced out of some of it. So it's not so much the public housing residents it's the surrounding neighborhood residents that there could be a lot of movement that's going on. And a lot of that had to do with, some of it's gentrification, some of it's, shifts because of economic trends that were going on. Some of it's then certainly in the last 15, 20 years, certainly there was an incredible amount of speculation. And housing boom and price booms that may have priced people out or whatever. So then
the other thing is, unlike a lot of other cities, to the high-rise issue, where cities got rid of their concentrated public housing in high-rises and gave people vouchers to get rid of them, they didn't.
They have them too. They have about 6,000. Actually, there's quite a few units. There's about 6,000 units of public housing that includes the conventional developments and the dispersed units. And then they have about 6,000 vouchers, which is obviously is privately run.
Here the movement was to get people moving into vouchers and out of housing.
Yeah, and so it's a little bit. Clearly, there's a lot of movement into the housing choice vouchers as well. There's a lottery system and stuff like that, but that is not the same as random assignment for sure. But they have a pretty large stock. It was interesting because we were talking about this, especially relative to Detroit, where I was based for most of the time. There is actually more units in some of that housing in Denver than there were in Detroit.
good despite the size.
Well, I want to thank you for coming to Pittsburgh.
Thank you.
And thanks, everybody. Grab our brochures on our Southwest Pennsylvania Community Program.